Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Hello, folks. I am John Najarian, and you're about to hear Compound Interests podcast. Today's guest, Chris Irons, writes a very informative column, and he tweets throughout the day, and he has a great podcast over at QTR, or Quote the Raven, because that's how he's known on Twitter, Quote the Raven Research. He writes for big hedge funds. He writes for Joes and Janes, and he does a great job of breaking down catalysts in the market. We talked today about what he was angry about, what he's happy about, what the Fed is doing, where we're going next in the market. And I think you'll be surprised that a guy who's pretty famous as a short seller might have a little bit of an optimistic view of the markets. So take a listen. Thank you for joining us. This is the Compound Interests podcast. Hello, welcome to Compound Interests. I am John Najarian. The gentleman next to the microphone is the one and only Chris Irons of QTR Research, Quote the Raven. So on Twitter, if you want to follow Chris, if you don't already, you should. Some great insightful and, of course, always, at least once or twice a day, some snark that might show up on your feed.
Depending on how many Fed governors are speaking that day.
Yeah, it depends if it's Brainerd or whom it might be. I was listening to your guy from Philadelphia this morning, in fact.
Yeah.
He sounded somewhat upbeat.
Yeah, they don't know what's going on. They have no clue. Inflation's going up. It's going down. We want over 2%. We want under 2%. The recovery's going to be V-shaped. The recovery's not going to be V-shaped. Nobody has a clue. Nobody has a clue. The whole speaking tour of when you are on the FOMC board and you got to do this thing where you go and you speak somewhere once a week, all that is, the goal of that is to just say something without saying something and just pass the time, I'm convinced. Because nothing material ever comes out of these speeches, but for occasionally an algorithm will pick up the Bloomberg headline and move the spoos a couple of points here and there. But it's a whole lot of nothing usually.
Now, folks, Chris writes very insightful and in-depth pieces that many hedge funds subscribe to. I can't name some of the ones specifically because he's asked me not to, but I know that people like Jim Chanos pay close attention to what Chris is writing about. He's also had some not that you're a short seller necessarily, Chris, but you've had Fleckenstein on your show, your podcast, because Chris does his own podcast that is very much a bookmark it, put it in your Apple Podcasts and everything else, folks. It's great. I think we had one that I listened to not too long ago, Chris, with Carson Block.
Sure. Yeah, he was on a couple of weeks ago. A couple months ago now.
So Chris gets some great guests. Rand Paul. Where did you pull that one out of, Chris?
Yeah, Ron Paul, actually. I had Ron Paul on yesterday. Ron Paul's he's been very accessible and quite nice to work with, Ron Paul. He's I know the gentleman that books him, that works with him on the Liberty Report, and he's a super nice guy. And I've had a great dialogue with them for a couple of years, and so every couple of months I've been able to have him on. It's been great, especially because Ron Paul was one of the guys that got me into libertarian thinking back in the 2000s when I didn't really even know that it existed. So it's always cool to talk to him.
Chris is coming to us today, folks, from, I believe, a secluded bunker in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
I am likewise secluded in Chicago. And the last time we talked, Chris, I was on my deck down at the lake, at Lake Michigan, when on your podcast.
Yeah.
And we were pontificating about the markets and the V-shaped recovery in the markets, which certainly has been so far a V-shaped recovery. I loved that because my buddy Mohammed El-Arian kept saying, well, John, this time it might not be a time to buy at the dip. The buy the dip philosophy, John, may have passed. And instead, I see a beautiful growing, and it's like, what? We're not going to see people buying on the dip? Do you really not think people are good? And sure enough, people that did buy on the dip, Chris, probably had a pretty good year this year. People that didn't, or the people that overstayed their short, because if you were short at the right times this year, you feasted on that fear, because we had 800 point down days, 1,000 point down days, 1,800 point down days, you know, that were just pounding the living crap out of everybody until, as you say, we got the Fed all singing the same tune, you know, no dissension whatsoever. They're just like, all you need, how much do you want? And then we actually got a couple of stimulus packages through the Congress that hates doing anything. We actually got a couple stimulus packages, and I definitely want to talk to you about that. But how about that V-shaped recovery? I mean, you know, when we got down to that, you know, the 18th or the 23rd, whatever the bottom of it was just a rocket ship out of there.
Yeah, it was the day that Bill Ackman said we've slipped into the seventh circle of hell, you know, with Slayer playing in the background on CNBC. And
yeah,
I think that was that marked the bottom. Really, the V-shaped recovery, though, has really been in the markets. It hasn't been in the economy. You know, the recovery is disproportionately showing up in the market because of what the Fed is doing, and it isn't showing up. It's showing up partially in the macroeconomic data, but if you were to objectively look at today's macro data and compare it, you know, if I told you a year ago that in, you know, on July 15th, we would have X amount of people out of work and the data would look as though, you know, the deficit would be what it was this month, you would say all hell's breaking loose and the Dow should be at 5,000. But we've gotten this massive intervention from the Fed, who has essentially backstop the entire corporate bond market and really printed and unfairly distributed about $5 trillion worth of purchasing power, most of which went to people that didn't need it, and not enough of which went to the regular everyday person. You know, everybody was kind of thrown a $1,200 breadcrumb while hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, was being forced upon private equity companies, any company really that has corporate bonds outstanding. So the Fed is sacrificing the free market and the bond market. They're manipulating the bond market and probably ruining the bond market in general, and definitely ruining the price of debt and the price of risk assets to reflect the correct amount of risk for many of these issuers. And I think that that is for a reason. I think that if you can make the market come back up by any means necessary, it gives the public, who often conflates the stock market with the economy, the optics of a recovery when there isn't necessarily a recovery, or certainly in this case, there hasn't been as significant of a recovery in the economy as we've seen in the market. So it is just another con job, really, is the best way to put it, by the Federal Reserve, which is layered on top of decades of con jobs, which is layered on top of decades of global fractional reserve banking Ponzi schemes, all kind of piled on top of one another. So I'd love to give you better news than that. I think from a good news perspective, if you want it to be a bull on the stock market, which I'm not really viewed as, which is interesting, because if you're skeptical about monetary policy, you're automatically written off as a permanent bear all the time. And while I think over a broad scope of time, we're really going to have to pay for all of this damage that we're doing, doesn't preclude me from being bullish every once in a while. And in March, one of the things that I said, which seems like forever ago, that was 4 months ago, when we really first started to get robust data on the coronavirus, and you've started to get the first indications that A, it may not be as deadly as we first assumed in January and February, and B, that it may have been around longer than we thought, there is an interesting case for a tailwind coming out of this. Because right now, let's just face it, the fundamentals don't matter. Valuations don't matter. It's that simple. I mean, value assets, nobody gives a shit about. You got these companies that make no money and are defrauding the public markets. I'm not going to name them, but scorching to market capitalizations of hundreds of billions of dollars. So the traditional rules don't really matter. The only question is, how is the market going to react when we inevitably get a vaccine, which we will? It's, you know, we have, I think, almost 100 vaccine candidates for the coronavirus. And we know coronaviruses in general very well. We have traditional vaccines. We have mRNA vaccines. We're going to have probably more than one vaccine. And we see, even today with the news, AstraZeneca and Oxford have one. Moderna has one. The data is looking decent. What's the tailwind going to be when we get that news, which is an inevitability, coupled with all of the QE that we've instituted over the last 3 months, which has really been a pornographic amount of quantitative easing compared to past levels? You know, essentially unlimited QE and 0% interest rates, which I think the Fed has already come out and said we're not even going to touch those interest rates until 2023. So what does the tailwind look like? And at this point, I mean, I could argue that the whole system is a disaster and it's going to come crumbling down. And I think that's definitely going to happen in the interim. I don't know if that'll be tomorrow. I don't know if it'll be in 6 months or 6 years or 60 years. In the interim, what's the difference between assigning a Shiller PE of 30 or a Shiller PE of 45 on this market? They're both absolutely fucking insane. And you know, one doesn't matter. It's like Tesla. What's the difference between giving it a $150 billion market cap when its equity is probably worth, you know, 1% of that, and giving it a $300 billion market cap? Really nothing. You're comparing unicorns to leprechauns. So I think just based on sentiment and, you know, what people call animal spirits, which I think is stupid, but that's a it's a little like out for people to just say, just buy stocks just to buy them. Oh, we've got animal spirits. You know, people are buying into the Keynesian bullshit now more than they ever have, is what they should really say. But I think by the end of 2021, the Dow could be over 40,000. I really do. And I've been saying that since March, and it's very strange of me to be bullish.
Yeah. Well, but you just did a great job detailing all of those tailwinds, if you will, or that rocket fuel that you've put into that. And, you know, I'm a guy that used to love fast cars, Chris. Now I drive a big old jacked up Jeep, but I used to like fast cars. And I know that, you know, the higher the octane I run in there, yeah, I'm going to blow some cylinder head. You know, I'm going to have some problems.
Right.
If I just really just, you know, jack it up to 100 octane and all the rest to get that power out. But it, for the short term, it's going to be really
fun. You're
going
to get fucking moving, right? Exactly. Yeah,
we're going to move fast. And that's what they've done.
I'm sorry.
No. Let me ask you as far as alternatives, because I have some alternatives that we could have done, none of which have been offered that I've ever heard anyway.
Sure.
Now, of course, you know, you're the president. You're more worried about, you know, your next cheeseburger and your Twitter account than anything else.
Right.
And I'm a fan, but I'm saying, you know, that's what we know what he's worried about.
Sure.
When's the next Big Mac coming? When's my Coke, my Diet Coke coming? And, you know, by the way, what's something snarky I can put out on Twitter? You know, those are more or less top several ideas that come to the president's mind 24/7.
Yeah. This is from you, by the way. You just had a McDonald's cup that you were drinking.
I did.
I just want to point out that for the record, so people know that you're not just ragging on all Big Mac eaters, but you obviously went to McDonald's today.
Although I'm animal style. So I get it just with lettuce And so I've got, you know, like three or four burgers. I get like two or three McDoubles or whatever, just on lettuce, Chris, and chow them like that.
You're doing the ketogenic.
I spend too much time on the treadmill and out walking around with my weight vest and all the rest of this. I'm not going to sit around and just shove bread that, you know, instantly becomes sugar in my system anyway. I don't need that. If I'm going to put on calories, it's going to be from booze.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you want something to convert to sugar, just drink, or if you want sugar to, or something to convert just to sugar, that you can do that with alcohol.
Yeah, thank God. So, but anyway, so you're the president and you get these things, you know, from Fauci and from Dr. Brix and all the rest. And you decide to shut down the economy. And if you shut it down, you've got to have a date. A time limit on it, Chris.
Sure.
It can't be indefinite because they have crippled the economy by doing that. That's why the Fed had to do what it did. It didn't do what it did because at that time, let's say it was 40,000 Americans had died. The Fed did what it did because, you know, probably 7 or 8 million would have died if they didn't start injecting liquidity into the system. But I have an alternative. And it doesn't have to be all the way to Sweden, Chris, but right now we've got my little calculator here. We've got 136,000 Americans, sadly, that have died of Corona, right? Or at least that have been cited as dying of Corona. Right. Maybe there's a couple extra thrown in there, you know, so that hospitals can get a little bit extra here and there. Or like that joke goes, the wife asks the husband, hey, do you think I put on some weight during all this quarantine? And he goes, not too much. So she shoots him and he's listed as a Corona death.
Right.
But so I think there's some of that in here, Chris. But anyway,
I agree.
Let's just say that you said, let's take the 70-year-olds and up. Let's take somebody with pre-existing conditions, in particular, if it's cardiovascular and or, you know, if it's respiratory, and morbidly obese and diabetics. Let's basically take that group. You guys all have to stay in. Chris, if you live with somebody like that, your dad, your brother, whatever, you've got to stay in too, or you can't live with them
right
for the time being. Okay. If we would do that, and then said to everybody else, look, some of you are going to get sick. Very few of you are going to die because that's what the stats say.
Right.
You know, I would say, what if they said, Chris, you know what? For everybody that goes out there and is, you know, trying to keep the, you know, the gears turning in the economy and so forth and so on. If you die, $2 million to your family, Chris, if you die of COVID. Now, times 136,000 people, Chris, $2 million times 136,000, you know what that is?
I don't know, $2 billion off the top of my head?
Yep, $272 billion.
Right, $270 okay. billion, okay.
Do you know how many trillion we spent because we locked all these folks down?
Do I know? Yeah, I know. I watch the M2 money supply all the time.
It's up 34%.
The question is, does everybody else in the world know?
Up 34% the M1 and M2 money supply through the roof.
Well,
you know, literally, when he came on 60 Minutes, when Powell came on 60 Minutes and said, let's just run the press. Let's run the press, guys. You know, we're going to print. We're just going to print. And they
first
said,
off, all right, so let me just address your idea just now.
Okay.
I think it's a terrible idea because I think monetarily we could do it, but I think it would incentivize people to kill other people. That's the first
well,
thing.
Well, but you got to kill of COVID.
What?
They have to die of COVID, Chris. They can't
Yeah. Listen, this would be like if you gave look, how many times a year do you see people murder other people to get their life insurance policy, which is like $35,000? You know, if you promise a family $2 million upon the death of somebody, everybody that got COVID and had it and was over the age of 70 would off themselves so that their family.
Guys don't qualify.
They would get that huge windfall.
But those guys don't qualify.
John,
Although that first group that I said that we carve out, they don't qualify. Only all the others qualify.
You mean the elderly and the people with pre-existing conditions?
All of that group, elderly.
Right, they don't qualify.
They don't qualify.
I think it's, well,
and
first
we got to pay them too, by the way. We got to pay them to stay in.
I think you make a couple of good points. I mean, I think that
Wait, just one sec though. My main point really is, Chris, that as stupid as that idea might sound, and maybe it's ludicrous,
right?
Maybe it's just batshit crazy. It's no dumber than what we did. In other words, what were the alternatives? Why did we not have any alternatives?
So I think there's two ways to look at this. I was very critical of the administration in February, very critical. I put out a Periscope the day that they did their first coronavirus task force briefing when Trump did his famous, you know, we have 15 cases and they're going to zero, that shit. And what I said in February, because I had been following the coronavirus since early January, what I said in February is we don't just have 15 cases and it's a bigger deal than people think, and that Democrats were going to replay that line specifically, and that that's what's going to cost him the election. I said that in February, which was 5 months ago. And
I do remember.
I still believe that that's the truth. But let me say this in defense of what we did. Okay. In January and February, we really didn't have a lot of insight into the virus. We knew that there was a novel coronavirus that had come out of China, but we didn't really have a lot of the details. And by the way, too, if we had used the case fatality rate that China first provided us with back in February, I remember looking at a chart of it. It was going up in lockstep, which is usually not a good sign when you're analyzing data. It usually means things are being fudged. But I think it was like 2.4%, even when, in my opinion, they were faking their data. So what we had there was we had a couple of things. We had perhaps the perception that this was far more dangerous than it's turning out to be, number one. Number two, we had a lack of data outside of China, which is something that I wrote an article about in late February or early March, basically saying that if there's a cover-up in China, whether it's with the number of infections or whether it's with the case fatality rate, we're going to find out when we start to get data from countries that we can trust, like Italy and like South Korea, Australia, and all these other places that popped up on the map. So we were flying blind to some degree in January. We were, and the majority of the information that we had was coming from China, which based on my experience, analyzing the Chinese government, which
not terribly truthful.
Right. Yeah. I don't really trust much of what they say at all, especially when it comes to data. I've seen enough bullshit Chinese macroeconomic data to understand that they make things up. So in January and February, we really didn't have a ton of visibility. And I was pissed in February that the government wasn't doing more. In January, I was on my Twitter feed putting out photographs of myself going out, getting masks, getting Tyvek suits. I mean, I was preparing for a proper pandemic that was going to be much worse than what this one is turning out to be, because we didn't know anything. We didn't know if it was a bioweapon. We didn't know if it was man-made. We didn't know shit about it. So I was trying to prepare for the worst. Once the government started to get their wheels turning in February, and they formed the coronavirus task force, I felt a little bit of relief, because then at that point, the problem had officially made its way into the mainstream media narrative, which I think, of course, the media is doing more harm than good. But the one thing that comes from that is it's something now that the government, the people now are all informed. I was worried not only that the virus was more deadly than China was telling us, but I was worried about the eventual shock and what I thought would be social unrest in the United States when we found out about the pandemic, and really when American households got it, you know, when it became an issue. I watched it in January go from being the little thing on the ticker on Fox News to eventually working its way up to being the lead story every day. So that's what I was preparing for. That's why I was out buying masks, why I was out buying, you know, ammunition, why I was out, you know, I was making all the requisite doomsday prepper stops, alcohol, you know, of course. And as things progressed through February and into March, and we started to get more and more data on the virus, it became clear to me, or clearer, that China wasn't lying, in my opinion, about the case fatality rate so much as they were lying about the number of total infections. Now, that sucks because they're still lying, but if you had to choose one of the two, that would be what you would choose, because I think that this spreads quicker than we thought. I think that it likely has been here longer than we thought. If China says patient zero was in November, I would probably say it was well before then. And it also means that the denominator in terms of figuring the case fatality rate is probably much larger than people think. So what we've seen over the last 3 months, while the government farts around with, you know, we're open, we're closed, wear a mask, don't wear a mask. I mean, nobody has any fucking idea. But what we're seeing with the data that really is the best that we can do with what we have is that the case fatality rate is plummeting with the amount of testing, as the amount of testing that we perform rises, which is why we've been getting all of this information, like the CDC now basically positing that the overall case fatality rate, including those with asymptomatic cases, is 0.3%, which is slightly more than the flu. I think the flu is 0.15%. But as the data gets more robust, it's becoming clearer and clearer that this is less and less of a threat than we had initially thought. So I don't fault the government for taking stringent action when we didn't have that clear of a picture. But I think now, I mean, in terms of my personal attitude to the virus, I am far, far less worried than I was several months ago. I recognize that there is a part of the population that is extraordinarily vulnerable. I think we need to do everything that we can to protect those people. But I also think that in 18 months from now, we're going to look back at what we did as a large overreaction, although at the time, I think a necessary overreaction. The two unknowns that we don't have that are still up in the air that can kind of fuck up the works a little bit. The first is how long the antibodies last. So I've seen a couple of peer-reviewed studies that suggest antibodies last only 3 months. Which for in the span of all coronaviruses is really on the short side. I think most coronaviruses are 6 months to 18 months. So if antibodies last only 3 months, the vaccine is going to become an annual thing like your flu vaccine. I think it'll become an annual thing anyways. The good thing now is all these balls are rolling. You have all these vaccines and heading, you know, from phase one to phase two to phase three, and they will be updated accordingly with the more information that we find out. So it took a long time for these wheels to get turning, but now they are turning, and the data is showing us, hey, this isn't as terrible as we first thought. So barring the antibodies, how long they last, and barring the other big unknown, which is what are the long-term effects of the virus, and we can't measure that until we have some time go by. You can't measure long-term effects until you have some time to work with. So what are the long-term effects on people's respiratory systems, on their brains, on their kidneys? So those are two things still up in the air, but all of the data I've seen over the last couple of months has indicated to me that we will probably have an attitude shift about this at some point in the future, and we will recover relatively sharply. I even disagree with Buffett. I think airlines will probably recover quicker than he thinks. I think he's right that they need to be looked at differently because they have new capital structures now. But in terms of the amount of business they're going to do and hospitality and travel and leisure, I think that's going to rebound quicker. I think the problem now is the media is focused on this absolute number of deaths and absolute number of infections. And so when you perform a lot of testing, the infections are going to go up significantly. The media has been very hypocritical in addressing that when it's convenient for them and not addressing that when it comes to the protests and the riots that have happened over the last couple of months. I think they're kind of using it as a tool. I don't think people should be surprised that this is going to make its way through everybody eventually. When I see the numbers go up X amount a day, I don't freak out. I say, all right, well, this is playing out.
Right. And
the number of deaths, like you said, there's no nuance.
Flat.
So you hear 130,000 deaths, but you don't know what their age groups are. You don't know.
Well, you can see them though. You can go in there and see state by state, you know, which of us were in which categories.
Sure. But when the media just shows you deaths are up and they say like CNN has 130,000 deaths and they keep the ticker going in real time on their screen, they're not saying these were people over 80. These are people over 70. These are people that are obese. These are people with pre-existing conditions. And also, these are people that have died from other things, but also happen to test positive for COVID. So, look, personally, I want people to be safe. I think the virus is very serious. I think that we need to protect the vulnerable and the elderly. But I personally am far less concerned about it than I was 3-4 months ago. As a matter of fact, one of my followers on Twitter just sent me a message yesterday with something I said in February, where I was just like, hey, like, it's based on what we have, it's much worse than the flu and this and that and the other. And he was giving me shit about it, you know, basically rubbing it in my face that now my attitude's changed. And I said, you know what? You're right. My attitude has changed.
Yeah. Well, I remember, Chris, about the same time you were saying that stuff, I was talking with Wapner on CNBC and I kept telling him it's a numerator versus denominator. And he kept looking at me like, you know, kind of quizzically. And I said, numerator, denominator. I said, the more we have on the denominator side, even if the numerator is a big number, like it is right now, 136,000 is a big number. But what's the denominator, Chris?
Well, and you have to understand, you have to understand at the beginning of any type of mass epidemic or pandemic, the people that are going to be included in the initial, you know, weeks, months of the data are the people that have it the worst, the people that present the symptoms and the most obvious symptoms. So it's the people going to the ICU, it's the people being put on ventilators, it's the people that are dying. Those are the people you get to first. You know, there were people walking around with this that were asymptomatic probably in November and December in the United States and January. I mean, that nobody really knew. Those people aren't getting counted. The denominator and the numerator both start with the people that had the worst effect from it because they're the obvious starting point. And so now you see kind of diverging from each other as the amount of cases go up and the amount of infections go up. Really, the amount of deaths hasn't ticked up significantly. Even if you look at it on a log scale, those two numbers are starting to diverge. So that's very promising and shows that, you know, likely this is hopefully only slightly worse than the flu.
Yeah. Well, what I like to say too all the time, Chris, is if it bleeds, it leads. And we all know that, you know, if it's, you know, Ms. Maxwell or Epstein, it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
If it is the coronavirus, they want to throw out those big numbers at us all the time. Oh my God, did you see how Texas spiked? What I can't believe, Chris, is that occasionally somebody from New York will actually think that Cuomo did a good job. And I'll say, why do you think that? You know, they have 1,165 deaths per million. I looked at it yesterday. Texas had 111 deaths per million, and they've got 10 million more people than New York. Florida, who's got more people than New York, and more old people, Chris, more people that are potentially vulnerable. And yes, they're not stacked up like cordwood, like in New York City, but there are plenty of high rises down in Florida, especially where the old people live. Why didn't they have these kind of you know, horrible statistics. 10x, as my friend Grant Cardone likes to say, 10x the number of cases in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts. I mean, these numbers are
you have three problems with the media, right? The first is, like you said, if it bleeds, it leads. So the most shocking thing is going to be what they lead with, and they purposely probably don't provide nuance on some things, like the death count, for instance. Another great example I always use is you always hear when a celebrity tests positive, like today, the Oklahoma governor tested positive, Rudy Gobert, the Utah Jazz tested positive, Tom Hanks tested positive, Justin Trudeau's wife tested positive. You never hear the story when they get better. They've recovered. Chris Cuomo tested positive. You know, there was no big story. Hey, he recovered. He got better. You know, so they go with the sensational line because they know that it's a business and that brings them viewers. That's the first thing. The second thing is you have truly in the news media a bunch of scared shitless snowflakes that don't really understand even the basic principles that we're talking about. They don't understand how at the beginning of testing, you're seeing predominantly people that are suffering the worst from it. And those are the people that can skew the data. They're not statisticians. They're not scientists. I mean, neither am I, but they're not looking at things like the case fatality rate really on a, and I looked at it over the course of several weeks on what looks like a very consistent and sharp decline based on the new amount of testing that we're doing. So they're just scared. It's like a dog that, you know, shits on the floor and then starts eating his own shit because he gets hungry. Like they start to buy their own fear mongering and they start to get really, really nervous because, you know, the CNN anchors go home and they watch MSNBC and they see a bunch of other scared shitless people that think that the virus is standing around a corner and it's going to jump out and, you know, kill them in their home. You know, the most of the media, the liberal leaning media, are really just snowflakes. They're easily scared and they are fragile. And so I think that's problem number two. And problem number three is most of the liberal leaning media have an interest in talking shit about the presidential administration now. And I'm not making this as a partisan comment. I mean, look, Fox News and OAN are hard right news stations, but CNN and MSNBC are hard left news stations. And so, and really most of the media outlets, you know, your ABC, your CBS, most of them lean left. So they have a vested interest when you look at somebody like CNN, who has spent really since probably a year before the 2016 election, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, criticizing the president. And you can argue whether it's worthwhile or not, but that's what they do. That's what their programming is. They have a vested interest in really making it sound like a massive disaster fuck up. And so again, then you get kind of people scaring the shit out of other people, which turns into this vicious cycle. And when really the truth is, I think, far less alarming. But John, that requires common sense and it requires reason and it requires objective examination of the data, which doesn't happen in the mainstream media, which is why you started a podcast and why I started a podcast, because, you know, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Because otherwise you don't get the story out there.
Correct.
And like I say, Chris, I would just love if there were some alternatives presented. I mean, so far, you know, the alternative was either the lockdown or Sweden. And there's something in between. Just like just like when there were the riots, there was a common phrase issued in Minneapolis and in Chicago and in New York, which was bricks versus bodies. In other words, we'd rather see them, you know, destroy parts of the city because that's just bricks. They can be rebuilt versus stacking up bodies if we start shooting these looters and things like that.
And how about they don't
there's
destroy,
something in between.
How about they don't destroy anything? How about protecting private property?
That's my point.
You know, I'm a libertarian. I don't want the government to do much, but I want equality under the law, as Peter Schiff said on my podcast a couple of days ago. How about you protect private property?
Yeah.
Just a thought. You know, the people that are out looting and rioting, they don't even know what they want. They really don't. You know, they are out there causing trouble under the guise of one banner while supporting an ideology that they're not familiar with the history of. And it's sad. It's sad. And what's even sadder is that we have dickless, cowardly politicians that allow these things to happen in their city. You know, like de Blasio, like Kenny here in Philadelphia. You know, these people, they see cop cars getting lit on fire. They see fights and private property destruction, and they're fine with it. You know, they're fine with it until you get the aha moment, like for the Seattle mayor, didn't want to disband the autonomous zone until the protesters showed up at her house. It's like, all right, hypocrite much, you know? Are you a hypocrite much? Until it's your private property, then it's not your fucking problem, right? And this is really, the liberal politicians across the country have really embarrassed themselves when it comes to this. And just to prove that I'm not partisan, by the way, you were talking about Andrew Cuomo before. I think Andrew Cuomo was handed a worse hand than the governors of many other states, because I think New York is a extraordinarily popular port of entry for people from China, specifically New York City. And I watched Cuomo, and I think he fucked a couple of things up, but I at least give him credit for the way he communicated every day. He was, you know, listen, I would see him give a press conference at 9 a.m, and then I would see him on TV at 10 o'clock at night on the same day, wearing the same shirt, wearing the same jacket. I mean, he wasn't farting around doing nothing. He was at least out there trying to get a response together. And there were some points where he worked with the administration well. So just to prove that it's not a partisan statement, it really isn't. But it's the liberal cities with the Democratic mayors and the states with the Democratic governors where you're seeing all this social unrest. John, if that's my city, if I'm the mayor of Philadelphia and I see all of this unrest in the city, it's very simple. I mean, I'm on the phone, I'm calling the president, I'm saying we need the National Guard. I don't give a fuck if people think, oh, well, it's a military state, it's a police state, it's this, that, and the other thing. Look, I'm a libertarian. I don't want the government in my life. I don't want the fucking police in my life. I love my civil rights. I love my civil liberties. I protect them, all right? I'm not Mr., you know, let's have the police everywhere in our lives. But also, I'm not going to let my city get burned and torched to the ground. And if it means that a couple people have to be uncomfortable and my reelection prospects go down slightly because people think that I'm too militaristic by protecting City Hall and protecting private property and protecting the business owners whose businesses I love to go to on the daily, then that's the price I got to pay. But I'm not letting fucking an enormous group of people take over the city. These people are insane.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and Chris, I'm sure you'd agree that there has never been a better chance that the Second Amendment will never, ever be repealed now. Because first of all, you know, you can't get an amendment repealed. It takes that 66% vote, you know, of the states and all that kind of stuff, which ain't happening. But I mean, when in Chicago, we watched Minneapolis burn for 4 days, right? The whole country probably started focusing on it the second or third night. If you weren't somebody from Minneapolis or you didn't have loved ones there, then you probably didn't know. You knew George Floyd died, but you didn't really know what was going on up there. Right. So when the mayor pulled the police back and said, you know, bricks, not bodies, they burned it to the ground. Uptown, an area that I used to go because I lived in Minneapolis for 12 years. An area that I used to hang out in. It's a cool area of Minneapolis, right next to Lake Calhoun, between Lake Calhoun and Lake of the Isles, and it runs down a street called Lake Street. And okay. Cool little businesses, lots of bars and restaurants and shops for about a mile and a half, 2 miles, all gone.
Right.
All gone, Chris. Gone. Can't be rebuilt. You know, They'll tear them down. I don't know, you know, it's just very, very sad. But Chicago and New York had the benefit of seeing that for 4 days.
So right. And preparing.
When they come to Philly, all of a sudden you go, holy crap, we're the fifth largest city in the United States. Philly. We are the third largest city in the United States and the second largest black population. You don't think that we're going to see some severe violence if you're seeing it in Minneapolis, a city of 450,000?
Well, and the media was stoking the fire the whole time too, because there were nights I was watching the media and they had a split screen 15 different ways and they were in 15 major cities. And they were basically saying, well, we saw riots in Minneapolis. Are we going to see something here in Chicago? Are we going to see something here in Philadelphia? It's like, why don't you just fucking tell people to leave their houses and go set stuff on fire, you morons? Like, of course they are. Now you're egging them on. You're stoking the fire. But just to go back to the Second Amendment thing, I mean, this is why the Second Amendment is so important. All right. This takes care of all these art. And look, I used to be an anti-gun guy. All right. I was a Democrat in my 20s. I didn't get it. Why do we need guns? Guns, you know, we used to have shootings and oh, it's terrible and whatever. I didn't get it. And I was never a hunter. You know, I had friends that were hunters, but I never was. To this day, I'm still not a hunter. You know, I'm pretty much 100% vegan. I don't even eat meat or fish or anything, you know. So I'm like a yay animals type person. But at some point after living in Philadelphia, it was really when I was living in South Philadelphia. I was living at 11th and Wharton, and I was bartending for a living, and I would walk all the way from Center City on 11th Street home from the bar that I worked at, which was like right near City Hall. I would walk all the way down 11th Street, all the way past Washington Avenue, all the way to Wharton, right, which was, I don't know, like 20 or 25 blocks, and I'd be doing it at 3:30 in the morning, carrying a glass of whiskey with me. And you start to, you know, think, man, maybe it's not a bad idea that I have a way to protect myself. Because when you're living in suburbia and there's no crime, it's very easy to think like, oh, well, what does anybody need protection for? But when you're living at 11th and Wharton and you're walking home at 3:30 in the morning, or even just chilling at your house. I mean, in Philadelphia, there's break-ins and shit all the time. I mean, I lived in Germantown. Was the same thing in Germantown. There was, you know, there was a shooting every day. There was a break-in every day. There was, look, and people, I don't even think people understand how cities operate if they've never lived in cities. You know, crime in a place like New York City or Chicago is very different than living in liberal suburbia, where you have your little hate has no home sign out in front of your three-bedroom, two-bath house. I mean, cities are a fucking reality check when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I start to think to myself, like, all right, like, maybe I need a way to protect myself. And I started by buying a big-ass machete. And I was like, you know what? I just keep this right by the bed just in case. Did I ever use it? Never used it. You know, people say, oh, you're more likely to hurt yourself. Fucking thing sat there for, you know, however many years. Took it with me. And then eventually, when I moved back, I went and got my when I started doing research on companies that had tremendous amounts of resources, you know, billions and billions of dollars to deploy, that were not happy with the company I was working for because they don't like when you call out their fraud publicly. I was thinking, like, these guys could make me dead very quickly. So maybe I should get a gun. And I did. And then I got more guns. And then I got more ammunition. And this is a perfect example. It's one of those things where, like, you hope you never need it. I've never fired my gun outside of the range before, ever. I hope I never do. But in a situation like this, when the people show up in front of your mansion, like that couple on that private street where they had that beautiful mansion where it looked like the fucking St. Sistine Louis. Chapel. They had the place painted and done up, and that was their life's work to, you know, get to where they were and protect their private property. Fuck yeah, I'm walking out on the front lawn with my AR-15. Are you kidding me? And the liberal media, like, oh, well, it was just peaceful protesting. They weren't going to do anything. I don't give a shit. And first off, that's bullshit. They were on a private road, number one. And number two, you know, for them to say as an afterthought, oh, nothing was going to happen. Nothing was, that's fucking bullshit. The people were antagonizing them. They were yelling at them. They were screaming at them. And let's just be frank for a minute, okay? Without even bringing race into the matter, the Marxist kind of riot crowd out there, what do they hate? They hate people with money. They hate fucking billionaires. They hate people that have a lot of nice things. And so, yeah, I would be out there doing the same thing. Was a shot fired? No. You know, that dude didn't fire the AR. People say, oh, well, the woman had bad trigger discipline, which is true. You know, she shouldn't have brandished the weapon, whatever. Hey, when it comes down to it, and it's me and you at my front door, you're not fucking getting in the house. It's that simple. And that's why I support the Second Amendment. Other than that, I'm a very nice guy. You know, if you knock politely and ask to come in and have a beer, you're more than welcome. But don't show up uninvited and try to fucking come in when I didn't invite you to.
Yeah, well, I'm looking right now, Chris, at a chart of Smith and Wesson, and the average daily trade in here was about 500,000 shares.
Okay.
Back in June, in late May, then when those as soon as those riots hit, it spikes to 10 times that, 6.7 million shares on the 2nd of June. And it has basically been between, between 2 and 10 million shares ever since.
Of course.
And, you know, I called a friend of mine out in Salt Lake City. He runs a shop called Ready Gunner.
Okay.
And he's a former Special Forces. Neil is his name. And he runs that shop, Ready Gunner. His wife is like an Instagram model. Her name is Buff Cookie.
Sounds you know, like on he's Instagram. Crushing it, this guy.
Oh, yeah. and, you know, he's it's so cool because, you know, everybody that works in the shop is former military, except right. for his wife. And they serve Black Rifle coffee and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Called out there and said, okay, look, turns out my wife can't chamber around in these big guns I've got.
Right.
Because, you know, you and I are big guys. I'm not saying I need a big gun, but it happened to be what I had.
Right.
And so, you know, when things were bad, when the cops disappeared here in Chicago, Chris, because they did.
Right.
Not because they were scared, but because the mayor told them to stand down.
Right, right.
So I said, okay, so here's how you, you know, here's how you load, you know, the magazine.
Right.
Because everybody thinks, oh, yeah, clip, you know, John Wick, he's got 16 of them around his waist.
Yeah. And you it's sit a little bit watching, different in real life.
Yeah, you sit there watching, you know, and they're loading them like this. And I said, do you know how long it takes you to load just an 8-shot clip?
Right.
Forget about a 16-shot, you know, for like a Glock or some of the bigger gun, you know, right. other ones. With and it takes a while unless you do it all the time, you know, like soldiers do it. It takes you a while. So anyway, I said, so you got to get comfortable with this part first. Before I show you anything about the rest of the gun, you got to be comfortable with putting the ammo into the clip.
Right.
You're going to need one clip on your side and then snap the other clip into the gun.
Right.
Okay. But now she can't chamber the round, Chris, because the slide on the Desert Eagle and on the 45 I have upstairs are too heavy.
Right.
You know, it's
well,
like,
those are big ass guns.
Yeah. You're trying to pull that thing back. And so, you know, I called Neil out there at Ready Gunner and I said, hey, do you have some of those fifth generation Glock 17s? And he said, nope, nobody does.
Sold out, right?
Yep. Nobody does.
One of my favorite videos from the rioting and the hysteria was from Rochester, which was unfortunately where that woman, that elderly woman, got the shit beat out of her by a couple of people while she was trying to protect her business. But there was another one of a guy who I guess owned, it looked like a pawn shop, but there were people outside the front of the pawn shop and you see the guy drive up, the owner.
Yeah, in a Durango.
Yeah, in the red Durango. And there's a guy commentating while it's happening. He's like, oh shit, here comes the owner.
Here comes the owner.
Oh man, the owner's not fucking playing. He pulls out a shotgun from the back of his Durango. And he fires two shots into the air and fucking people go scattering in all directions. That's called problem solved, because the police aren't always going to be there. And especially now, I don't fucking blame them. I train jujitsu with a bunch of police officers. Okay. I've said to all of them, how do you guys even go back to work? Like, you know, they say, oh, one of them's a state trooper, was down in Philadelphia dealing with this over the last like week or two, saying, hey, we're down there. People are spitting in our face. People are this close to us, you know, and they're telling us, don't be confrontational. Don't arrest them. Don't assault them. You know, I said, dude, if they're spitting in your face, that's assault. You know, they're like, yep, we're told not to do anything. It's tough, but we don't do anything. So they're really, there's a lot of really good cops that are really enduring a lot of shit that they don't deserve to shit to endure right now. And, you know, that's kind of unfair also too. So.
Yeah. Well, Chris, in the time we got left, let me hit you on some market related things.
Sure.
Short sellers. Obviously, you have famously, I'm not saying you're a short seller, even though you know the art better than I do.
I am a short seller. So it's okay if you say that.
But when you've got some of these stocks moving up like they do, occasionally, not all of them go straight up, but especially with large short interests and things. Obviously, I watched Tesla go from a 30% short interest down to 9, you know, as it's gone to stupid levels, you know, $1,700 and
well, you should
like
know about Tesla. I mean, do you think that that's just a giant gamma squeeze? Do you think Tesla's being manipulated by the options action?
Somewhat. I mean, Chris, a week ago, we saw 3,000 of the 1,400 calls got bought.
Right.
For like $300 a piece.
Right.
Now, since every option's for 100 shares, that's $30,000 per option to buy the stock at 1,400 when the stock is trading 1,300.
So, which is insane.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
It's insane. I mean, if you watch options for a living like you do, and you know, I have a lot of flow trackers too. This all started before that first run up to 1,000 where the stock was 300, 400, John. And I was seeing, that was March. I was seeing October 1500s. I was seeing October thousands going off, real steam and out of the money strikes in later dates. And I was like, something weird is going on here, and it has continued. And I mean, you got guys in there now buying a 3,500 strike call that expires in fucking 2 days. That's insane. You would need 120% move in the stock, which is already absurdly overvalued. Something is going on with Tesla in the options market. I can't pinpoint it, and I don't know what it is, but it feels to me like a gamma squeeze, and I don't know if that's intentional, if somebody's doing it on purpose, or as some other people have suggested to me, maybe somebody had some type of floating strike exotic instrument or something where they got caught in some kind of fucked up derivative that we don't know about, which could also be a thing.
Also, so when you have a short position, because as you say, you've had to defend short positions before, do you ever own a call against your shorts just so that you, you know that, you know, as bad as shit might get, I'm not going to get cleaned out?
Well, in the market today, since there's really no way is up, right? The market does whatever it wants and the fundamentals don't matter and the valuation doesn't matter and the total addressable market doesn't matter and the gross margin doesn't matter. Nothing matters. So you got to hedge now more than ever. So there's definitely been times where if I'm short, if I'm just, you know, maybe I just buy a put spread or I just, or maybe I just get directional short from buying vanilla puts or maybe I'm short a big chunk of equity. A lot of times I will buy out of the money calls just as a hedge, you know, whatever, 5%, 10% capital allocation versus the size of my, whatever my short position is, just as a hedge. And it saved my ass more than once too. I mean, more than once it saved my ass on Tesla. So.
Now, how about something like Goldman's earnings today? So we're recording this, folks, on Wednesday, the 15th. Goldman had earnings, blowout earnings, and just like JP Morgan, their traders blew it out.
Yeah.
It wasn't anything else at Goldman. It was the traders blew out.
It wasn't their loan book.
Yep. So what do you think of a Goldman right here or of a JP Morgan? Because you're probably, like the rest of us, not exactly throwing tons of money at those stocks. But on the other hand, some of them are just crazy cheap.
Well, I actually own JP Morgan. So I actually didn't look at Goldman's report this morning. So it's news to me. I knew all the banks were reporting this week. And I knew that the loan loss provisions were supposed to be monstrous. And I knew that they were all supposed to be offset by higher than expected trading revenues. So I didn't get into the details of the report, but I own JP Morgan. I think it's cheap, you know, just on a price to book valuation and, you know, versus financial assets. Traditionally, I think all the banks are going to come back. I think any losses that banks incurred to their share price as a result of the coronavirus will eventually all be bought back and probably bid back up past that, because this is a financial problem to some degree, but it's not a systemic financial problem. And so you have that, number one, and you have the Federal Reserve, which is providing unlimited liquidity and an unlimited backstop to the banks. So if you're buying the banks now, you're pretty much buying the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know, a company like JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs is not, in my opinion, in any type of, you know, doesn't pose any type of systemic risk or major risk. So those, the financial names, are ones that I actually like to buy on the dips, even now that the market has recovered, because the financials, as you know, that sector, I think, is still off like 25 to 30% this year. So that's nice, because I think that they are being overlooked. It's not like hospitality where, yeah, there's going to be some real fucking pain going forward that you're going to have to deal with. So like an airline stock would be totally different, because you'd really have to think about, well, is business going to change, whatever. But financials, you'll see an impact in loan losses as the economy starts to recover. Those will recover. And banks are so diversified. And again, they're backed by the Fed. So, and you have the, you know, you have the disproportionate value in banks that you don't have in some other equities right now. I think by far, hospitality, travel, and leisure are still probably pummeled, you know, 60, 70% off highs here. Like American Airlines trading for 13 today, was trading at 50 a couple of years ago. I think a win on that stock is if it gets back to 25, 30 with its new capital structure. I think it's totally possible. I think it's possible maybe within a year. But I like the banks, and I love the names like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, because as much as I hate the system, and trust me, nobody loathes central banking more than I do, those entities like that are as close to a bet on the Death Star as you can get. And they're as close to a bet on just betting on the Fed as you can get. So if you want a pure play Keynesian circle jerk, maybe owning Goldman Sachs is the best way to do it. CEO's a little weird, though. I'd take Diamond over DJ David Solomon. The fuck is that? You're outrunning a $500 billion bank and you're DJing. Not that I blame the guy. I mean, if I could be DJing in Turks and Caicos every weekend, sucking down tequila, I'd be doing the same thing. But like, dude, all right, come on. Like, you know, you're 50 years old. If you want to be a DJ, that's fine. You're worth several billion dollars. Just fucking retire from Goldman Sachs.
What about an equal weighted S&P? So in other words, you and I know whenever anybody on TV complains about, look at where the market is. The market's, you know, what is the market thinking? And I always say, Chris, the market's thinking, this is a capitalization weighted index, you idiots. So what do you expect when they say, well, the top five stocks account for 26% of the movement and blah, blah, blah. Of course they do. It's cap weighted, you morons. Right. You know, if you want to reverse it, if you want to throw American Airlines and all the hospitality stocks, anything where you have to be face to face,
right?
Hospitality, like in hotels, restaurants, airfare, cruise lines, all of that stuff. You want to put all of that and say, okay, now that will reflect where the economy is right now. That'll reflect the shitter that we're in, but that ain't what the S&P is. It's capitalization weighted. So what about equal weighted? which they have, of course, equal weighted S&P. Would you buy any of that now? Because maybe you're starting to see some of this rotation.
Well, I would, first off, I got to preface my answer by saying that I think the country's monetary policy and global monetary policy is a giant Ponzi scheme and will eventually just wind up imploding. And that's why my favorite position is gold. With that being said, you know, and I don't understand when the timing of that is going to happen because it's an unprecedented experiment. It's going to have unprecedented results. So don't try to predict when the thing's going to go tits up, but I know that it will at some point. Having said that disclaimer, in the short term, I don't really see any big headwinds for the market until maybe the election. Because then if Biden wins, you're going to have to deal with a lot more regulation and higher taxes and things like that. So I don't really know how the market's going to respond to the election. If you want to say all things are equal and Trump's going to stay president in November of this year, I wouldn't mind an equal weighted S&P exposure because I can't believe I'm saying this shit because I sound like one of these guys on CNBC. But I remember I said my disclaimer ahead of this. I probably wouldn't mind it only because, again, it's not about sentiment and it's not about economic activity that much anymore. It's about the Fed. And the central banks have made it clear to me that their only mandate is the stock market. It's not price stability. They don't really, I don't think they give a fuck about inflation. I also don't think that they understand inflation. That's number one. And it's obviously not job creation. I think that their sole mandate is the stock market. And I think they'll do whatever needs to be done for the market to stay up and stay comfortable. They will support the market. And I think at the same time that that happens, so when we get like what would be a 1% nugget of good news in a situation where like maybe the ISM number comes in and it's a beat or whatever, you know, the market views that as like 100 times more important than it is because of how volatile the market is and how thirsty a Fed-backed market is for good news only. And I think that for better or for worse, we're just going to get a lot of good news over the next 6 months, 12 months. I think that, you know, the Fed isn't going to make any hawkish moves. I think that we have tailwinds behind us with the virus. I think people are going to start to understand that the virus is less lethal than we thought and maybe less lethal than the media is letting on. I think that economic activity in the beaten down areas, specifically leisure and hospitality, is going to, again, catch a bid. And I think when that happens, we may not see recoveries to pre-COVID highs in that sector, but you know, I can broadly say there's a number of stocks in hospitality and leisure that I think could double in the next year easily without even, you know, I would say even if you could, if there was an index out there of hospitality and leisure names that wasn't made up of total shit that's going to go bankrupt, like that I think would just have a chance of doubling within a year because I think people are thirsty to get out of the house. I think people want to return to normalcy. And I think that more robust data and a better understanding of that data is going to quench that thirst for people. And it's going to enable them to do like what my friend is doing that I was just texting today. You know, he's in his early 50s. I said, what are you doing today? He said, I just got to Ocean City, Maryland. You know, I'm here, I'm at the beach, I'm out, I'm spending money, I'm having a drink, I'm going to the bar, I'm doing this and that and the other. I think the all of the closures that are happening again, Louisiana just closed, California just closed. I think those will be lifted eventually too. I think those are kind of nervous overreactions. Of course, the data is going to tick up when we reopen and at the same time testing, right? And testing continues to expand. So I think there's a lot of tailwinds and I think we're going to get great headlines about vaccines and therapeutics going forward. Like the Moderna headline yesterday, it wasn't especially great. It was a phase one headline, but what did we learn? You know, there were some side effects, but it produced 2 to 4 times the antibody response that would be necessary in people, which is robust. And I think we're just going to get a litany of that type of information going forward. We have so much torque and the global scientific community behind solving this problem. It's in everybody's interest, whether you manage a Pep Boys in your local township or you're the CEO of Merck or you're me or you're you. Everybody's incentivized to come up with a solution to this problem. And I think it's going to happen. So as much as it fucking pains me and as much as it doesn't make sense based on the fundamentals, I do think the market could go higher from here. And I wouldn't mind owning an equal weight S&P ETF here. And I hate hearing myself say that, but that's the truth.
Now, last one, last question, Chris, because I got to be respectful of your time.
I don't have a life.
Davey Day Trader Global Global. DDTGG. Since he added the second G on there for because he's bigger than just global. I'm global, global. What do you think about him being the Pied Piper for all these kids that have flooded into the market like we have never, ever seen before?
Well, I discussed this on a podcast I did last week with this guy named Charlie Bathgate, where we talked about the influx of Robinhood traders and how it skews the market by the capital that they're deploying in the market, but also how it fucks with people's heads too, because they're in there bidding up garbage. And like I said many times, the fundamentals don't really matter anymore. So it's really, if you're an old school value investor, if you're a Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett type guy, you probably don't know which way is up right now, because you have frauds running through the roof. You have garbage companies doing offerings and raising money at insane valuations when they aren't generating even revenue. And you have an army of people that think that the stock market is a video game because now they have it on their phone on Robinhood. So it's super easy for them to go in and trade. You can log on to, you can log on to Wall Street Bets and you can see, some boner in his basement that turned $400 into $1 million by buying out of the money Tesla call options. So that increases the volatility. And I think that, look, I want those people to have at it, go in and learn the hard way. Everybody will. That's how I learned. I'm sure that's how you learned too, John. I think Portnoy is funny because in this market environment, like he can come in and just talk shit and gunsling, even though he doesn't really understand a lot of what he's doing, and still be right, which to me, I find amusing because I love seeing the suits, as he calls them, the pinstripe suit people. I love seeing those people disheveled. And I like it when Ron Insana comes out and criticizes Portnoy. And I know Ron Insana's financial acumen far exceeds Dave Portnoy's. But I like watching Portnoy come back and just say, hey, fuck you. I'm up 300 grand today. You bald prick. Nobody fucking listens to you. And like, he can do that without having any clue what he's talking about because the market's enabling to do that because the market is rewarding speculation and it's rewarding, the Ross Gerbers of the world and the Kathy Woods of the world. So it's very interesting. It's like science fiction, but I got to give Portnoy credit. First off, the dude makes me laugh. Like a couple of his clips that he put out really crack me up. I was actually thinking when I was looking at my shirt and I noticed we were both wearing Hawaiian shirts. He's always wearing Hawaiian shirts too. I was like, oh, people are going to think I'm ripping off Dave Portnoy's shit. And I was like, no, this is just the shirt I'm wearing today. And me and you, we didn't dress up to look like a fucking Hawaiian dance team today. We both just happened to be wearing Hawaiian shirts. But I got to give Portnoy all the credit in the world, man. He's a self-made man. He made himself into a millionaire many times over. He's earned the right to say whatever the fuck he wants. If you don't like it, sue him and hash it out in court. But
I love
his line. Can't fault the guy.
Chris, I love that line when he says, you can bet against me, but people have been doing that for 2 decades.
Right.
Nobody's cashed a winning ticket yet.
Couldn't tell you, couldn't tell you what a discounted cash flow model is, but just out there talking shit. And I appreciate that because that's my fucking business model too, right? Just go out and talk some shit and see what happens.
Yeah, and it is a little different. I'll say, for instance, some of us, I'm not saying that this is necessarily me, but some of us that have been doing this for a long time, we have those 100,000 hours in trading.
Right.
I was doing some back of the envelope calculations the other day, Chris, and I think I'm like 70 or 75,000 hours of trading. And we've all heard that thing about 10,000 hours, once you get to that 10,000 hours, you know, then yeah, you can play the guitar behind your head,
right?
You know, do all this stuff because you've put in the time. You are that expert. Dave is much more like, you know, a guy that, you know, can fly the crap out of that Cessna, but probably would get into the cockpit of the jet and have some trouble because, you know, it's what are all these gauges? What's all this stuff? You know, I just know this. I just know push it forward and put the nose down or pull the nose back up or whatever.
I don't know. The government wants you to believe that Hani Hunjur, who couldn't even pilot a Cessna, hopped into the cockpit of a commercial airliner and flew it directly into the Pentagon. But that's a different story for a different day. just to ruin your analogy and ruin the vibe for a second with one of my
with one of your conspiracy theories.
Well, yeah, it's a topic of interest for me. But yeah, I think you're right about Portnoy. And I think, you know, John, listen, man, you're fucking old school. You were on the floor of the CME, and you know that these people eventually wind up getting their due. It happens to everybody. It's a matter of how long you come into the market and feel comfortable before you get your ass kicked, but everybody has gotten their ass kicked that has been in the market, and you know it's kind of like a rite of passage. So I don't have to tell you that, you know.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean that what I'm most enthused about, Chris, is that he brought this army of day traders to this. Yeah. And you accurately said it's because of this. It's because I can do it as an app on my phone through Robinhood and so
yeah.
forth. I think many of them will succeed, and many of them will fail. A third of professional traders every year failed on the floor.
Right.
About one third would right. like blow out. Why? Lose your discipline, bad read.
The yeah, guy that any number of things, right?
Yeah,
the stuff that, the guy that, used that everybody's to stand susceptible
next
to.
You that was always right, isn't there anymore. You just got divorced and you're pushing, you know, too hard because you want to get it all back.
Yep.
You know, there's a million reasons why guys all of a sudden and gals fail. But to have that much more into the markets now. I think it's a little bit like fresh blood, and I don't mean blood like blood in the water, because I'm not trading with those guys. But I mean, it's good to see a little more retail in the markets, because I think we were getting close to 90%, HFTs, algorithms,
yeah,
and just machine driven. If we've actually, CNBC wrote that we might have swung back towards 80%. So in other words, that's doubling, you know, going from just 10% market trading and retail and so forth to maybe 20%. That's a good thing if we did that.
Yeah.
I'd be happy with that. So.
Yeah, well, it definitely mixes things up. And again, you know, there's some old school value investors out there that are just contemplating suicide because everything they've ever learned their entire career seems to be going out the window. Which, yep. You know, as a market observer and somebody that doesn't really, you know, I haven't bought into our system the way that it runs, to say the least. I find that amusing. So,
well, I always find you insightful and amusing. And it's been too long, Chris, since we had drinks together. So
that's
got to make that happen soon.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Thank you, Chris.
John, it was my pleasure, brother. Thank you so much for having me on. And we'll have you on my podcast soon again, too.
Cool. Folks, that's Chris Irons. Thank you, Chris.
All right, John. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.